Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. Good evening, virtual audience. Thanks for joining us. It's my great pleasure to welcome back Graham Brown with another Pneumophile adventure. How long have we been doing this?
You know, time flies. It's been about 12 years now since I started working with Clive. And for the longest time, I've still felt like it's brand new. So, yeah, 12 years. But I'm pretty sure in my brain, I'm still like trying to get the hang of it.
But you really like this kind of book, because back before you started working with Clive, you actually wrote two kind of adventure stories. One of them, I think, was set in, what, Mexico, Central America? I have a hazy memory here.
Well, you've got about a million books here, so I'm not surprised that sometimes you don't remember all the intricate details.
Right?
But my first book was set in the Amazon.
Okay. Well, I'm in the right direction.
You're in
the
south. You're south. It's hot. It's humid. You're definitely in the right direction. And so there were two books. It was Black Rain, and then the follow-up was Black Sun. And they were kind of like two parts of the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a third book in that series called The Eden Prophecy. And you were kind enough to let me come here and try to sell my $7 paperbacks to a small audience. And you know, that I really feel like that was the start of a lot of this. So, but we did three of those. Started working with Clive about 12 years ago, and I think this is our 11th Pneumophiles book that I've worked on. And prior to that, Paul Comprecos did 8, I think.
He did. So what drew you to this kind of story? I mean, there, if of all the book kinds of stories you could write, what was it that drew you to this kind of action adventure in an exotic landscape with, you know, evil actors and all the rest of it? It's so much fun.
I was just going to say, doesn't that sound like fun? What?
Yeah.
Why would you not write that kind of book? I mean, I think all authors are kind of trying to live vicariously through their characters. No matter, you know, some of us are more adventurous and actually get out there like and find lost ships like Clive did, and others of us just kind of read about it and go, oh, that sounds really cool. But I'm going to go get another latte, and I'll be here in the coffee shop when they pull that thing up. But either way, you're still thinking about the adventure. You're still kind of living in this imaginary world. And it's kind of, I feel like it's kind of natural. All the authors I talk to, all my friends who write, you often hear the same thing. Like, well, that was the kind of story.
A comment from the audience. Sorry. Right.
That's the kind of story that you would imagine as you were just kind of daydreaming. And then it was kind of a simple jump to go from there to actually writing it down and trying to have it published as a novel. So
right. Well, I've always loved, you know, H. Rider Haggard, King Solomon's Mines, all those kinds of wonderful books. And it seems to me that before technology, they really sort of, it was choose your landscape, you know, choose wherever it was going to go and then work out a story for a lot of them. Technology gives you a different problem. So depending on the book, do you start with a, because it's gotten to be harder, it has to be harder and harder to find a location that you haven't written about before, where you can have some kind of adventure.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the hardest things. Not just the landscape, but the story itself. When I would work with Clive on these books, I would come up and meet with him, and we would talk over a bunch of ideas and just brainstorm random things. And I probably told this story 15 times, but the number of times that I would say, "Ooh, Clive, I got a great idea. What about this?" And he would look at me and he'd kind of nod, and then he would say, "Yeah, I think we did that in Pacific Vortex." And then I'd come up with another idea, and I'd be like, "Well, what about this?" Like, "I think we did that in another book." And it's just like, the hardest thing was to find something Clive hadn't done already and that, or we hadn't done, because it's occasionally it would happen the other way around. At one point, he mentioned an idea that he thought would be really cool. I'm like, yeah, that was the plot of Black Sun. So it's like, I was like, so it's just, you know, you're looking for some kind of new territory, both geographically or, you know, plot and story wise. And when you find something like that, you know, suddenly you get energized. And when you can't find it, you feel like, you know, you feel like a guy climbing up the mountain, and every time you get, you know, up one level, you look and somehow the mountain's just still as high as it was before you started. So
additionally complicating your search, you need to have access to water for the Pneuma thing. You can't, you know, it's not going to be, well, we won't mention the word Sahara, but right. But it is, you can't really do one in Kansas, for example.
I remember proposing a whole story to Clive, and he listened the whole time, and then just seemed like he liked it. Said, but you know, at some point they have to go to the ocean.
Right.
So it's like
requires water.
Okay. Yeah. All right. They're not mountain climbers, but
right. So I'm actually going on a cruise to the Great Lakes starting on Monday, which I think is going to be really fun. And I, you know, that's the one sort of large bodies of water that I can't remember any of the Kustler team going into, but maybe it's just not big enough.
Yeah, I can't remember
Lake Superior
which one it is, but
is there actually a Great Lakes book?
Yeah, I think there is one.
What would it be? Remind me.
It's one of the originals, like.
Way back. Okay. Oh, hi. Which one? Night Probe. Okay. In Lake Michigan. Right. Lake Superior is actually a tremendous body of water. But
well, and Clive might have been waiting, because for a long time, him and his NUMA guys were looking for a ship or an airplane that went down up there. So he might have been waiting till he found one to put it in the... Now I can put it in the story. So.
Okay. So anyway...
Are you going to be looking for anything while you're up there?
No, I'm going to be in the massage parlor. I'm going to be right. Actually, we're going to go to some places that, strangely enough, my husband has never been to Mackinac Island or Niagara Falls, which doesn't sound, you know, necessarily fabulous, but nonetheless, he's not been there. I have never been to Cleveland. Aha. So we'll visit Cleveland, and then we end up in Toronto, where I have scheduled meetings with, I think, 5 authors in one day. And then there are a lot of Canadian authors that don't come down here. And then we're taking a train to Quebec, which, again, the St. Lawrence Seaway is a really cool body of water.
Yeah, actually.
The whole St. Lawrence River, which I have done. We have gone all the way down the St. Lawrence and out into the North Atlantic, but... So I'm just suggesting possibilities here. But anyway.
Well, if you do find anything while you're up there.
I will let you know.
Just definitely send us a text.
I will do that.
Want to know what's happening.
Right. So, but in addition to landscape, and you're going to need a plot, has the advent of technology, you have to also find technology that maybe you haven't had to wrestle with. This is all playing into this book, because two things are happening here. One, we have Cuba. And two, we have the return of airships like the Hindenburg.
Yeah, so the technology thing's kind of a double-edged sword.
Right.
The first problem with the technology is one of the keys to writing a great story is, you know, your heroes have to be in danger, mm-hmm. and they can't really just call for help. Otherwise, it'd be kind of boring. So, you know, you're always constantly looking for ways that something happens to the radio and the satellite phone and the internet and everything else so that they can't just call for help and they got to figure it out themselves. So that's the negative part of the technology. But the great positive part of the technology is, especially in a book like this, where you can take something that's basically cutting edge and it's real or realistic and turn it into fiction. So I think that the airship thing has intrigued me forever, because I can't imagine flying on a ship that's basically like an ocean liner, but you're 1,000 feet off the ground and it's moving like you're, you know, weightless. It's not like flying on an airplane. It's silent. It's quiet. It's like you're just drifting through the sky on a cloud. And I have found that to be like, I've been waiting for somebody to come up with, okay, we're going to bring airships back and we're going to start a cruise line and you can go on them and you can go on adventures around the world. The interesting thing is, I've recently found that the guy who started Google, and this was after, found this out after we actually finished the book, is he has a very secretive airship manufacturing program that they're working on. So, and he's probably watching this right now, so... Sergey, if you need someone to come test out your airships, I'm willing to volunteer.
It's really too bad that, you know, the Hindenburg had this incredibly flammable fuel, because, you know, if there were a way to power one, which there probably is today, where it's like balloons with hydrogen, you know, if you can send up a balloon using something that won't burst into flame, it would be so much better.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is, the Hindenburg was filled with hydrogen because at the time, America was the only country with helium. Helium doesn't lift quite as well as hydrogen, but it doesn't burst into flames. But the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about why the Hindenburg actually caught fire, and because there were many airships flying around at that time operating on hydrogen, and they had thousands and thousands of hours of operating safely. It seems like it's kind of like a random series of events. They were venting some hydrogen as they were trying to land. There was a really large static electricity buildup in the sky because it was humid in New Jersey. And then basically a spark lit this hydrogen, and then that was that. But they don't have to work off hydrogen. And obviously, if anybody ever does create a new airship line, it's probably not going to be hydrogen that lifts you up. It's going to be helium. But there's all kinds of more modern ways to create an airship that's different than what we did back then. You know, those airships were made of aluminum, which was pretty lightweight, but we can use things like carbon fiber, which is even lighter. And they were covered in basically what's like goat skins that were painted to try to reflect the sun. Well, we can cover them in much lighter fabrics and more weather resistant. And you could end up with a ship that could do incredible things. And I think it's coming. But in our story, it's already here. That said, there's a mystery as to why they're here and what they're actually doing while they're traversing the skies. So that kind of technology plays into the story, I think, by creating that mystery, because it's like, here's this great ship that's flying around, and it's different than an airplane because it can go anywhere it wants, and it can do kind of whatever it wants, because it doesn't need an airport, it doesn't need a runway, it doesn't need, you know, and it can carry so much more than you could ever put on an aircraft.
Are they conceivably luxurious inside if you're willing to pay to outfit them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even the Hindenburg and the old airships, they were basically like flying ocean liners, but with a very small number of passengers. But in our story, they are definitely, people are living in the laps of luxury in those.
Well, I mentioned the Hindenburg because it was that explosion, I think, turned people off, or maybe they were all grounded. I can't remember what, but it really put a serious damper on airships.
Yeah, that was kind of the end of the airship era,
right.
But you know, it was times were changing. World War II started, and by the time we got past World War II, aircraft could fly longer, farther, faster. There was nobody had any plans to bring airships back.
So Cuba, why? I was really impressed that Cuba was the focal point of this. For one thing, it's very close to the United States, so you know, there's more imminent danger to what's going on for people on the ground here.
Yes, so it's interesting. Just like the technology or the geolocation, it's really hard to find, you know, villains that don't feel like you're just doing stock villains that other people have done or are doing right now. You know, there was a point in the midst of the creation of the book where there was an idea that the villain might be Russian. And, you know, we came to the conclusion that, you know, 500 books are going to come out with Russian villains in the next few years. We don't want to do that.
Actually, several came out this summer. So, you know,
yeah,
there we are.
It's everywhere all of a sudden. And there's nothing wrong with that. But one of the things that Clive always wanted to do, and I think he's totally right about this, is you got to zig when everybody else zags. You got to kind of do something different than what the standard book that's going to come out is going to look like. You got to kind of do something different. So we started looking, I've always been very interested in the fact that here's Cuba. It's 90 miles from the United States. There are millions of Cuban people living in America that have connections with Cuba. And there are a lot of people in Cuba that have connections with America. And yet it's one of the few countries in the world that we still have a full-fledged embargo against, as if it's the middle of the Cold War. And it's, you know, they are somehow our lethal enemy, when the reality of it is they can barely feed themselves at this point. But that gives you great fodder for, like, okay, if you're looking for somebody who's going to have a grudge and want to harm the United States of America, you got to find somebody that really has a real reason to do that. And the villain in this book is basically a guy who spent 20 years working for the Cuban intelligence community, working because he believed in Fidel Castro and the communists, and working to try to weaken America and bring America down. And then eventually, as all of that kind of crumbled, him and his group were cast out, as he says, by the old men in Havana. And they were basically, you know, shoved aside. But all these years of resentment and anger are still built up inside him. So he continues to sharpen the axe of revenge in his mind and search and search and search for a way not only to get back at the people who he believes sold Cuba out, the old men in Havana, but also to get back at the United States. And by using his intelligence background, he fights his way or cons his way into a position where he may be able to use these airships and the technology that they represent to do just that.
Was it, I mean, has it ever been a goal of Cuba to conquer the United States?
Not to conquer us, but to kick us out of Guantanamo Bay.
Ah, okay. So much more focused.
Yeah, absolutely. During the revolution or before the revolution, the United States had a deal with the government there to control Guantanamo Bay. And even after the revolution, we just said, well, we're going to stick with the old deal. And it's my understanding that to this day, we send checks to the Cuban government of some amount that might be like $5,000 a year or something to pay for the lease of Guantanamo Bay. And they refuse to cash them, but we keep sending them. And for the Cuban villain and the communists in Havana who would love to get rid of, you know, can't stand this American intrusion on their soil, you know, this is a flashpoint for them. But really, what can they do? There's nothing they can do about it unless there is. And that's something you might find out in the book.
Right. So what technology comes into play in the book? It's one that nobody has ever quite figured out if there is such a thing.
Yeah. So there's this really interesting historical problem that began to occur several years ago. They call it Havana syndrome. And basically, people in our embassy in Havana and at certain buildings that were occupied by American contractors, you know, State Department people and stuff like that, they started to come down with these really bizarre neurological symptoms that just came out of nowhere. And it wasn't just
air conditioning, for example. I'm sorry it makes that horrible crash. It's not going to fall on your head. It's just loose.
Are we sure it's not an airship crashing on us?
No, I don't think so. Well, we're gonna have to fix it because it makes a perfectly horrible banging sound. I saw you jump when it did that, so I wanted to assure you it wasn't going to come down on your head.
If only it was Halloween and we're talking about a ghost book, and then the air conditioning can bang, the lights can go off. But yeah, so Havana syndrome is a very like mysterious set of symptoms, and some people consider it a hoax, other people consider it a real thing that has happened. It's happened not just in Havana, it's happened in South Korea, Moscow, certain other places where our embassies are. There are people within the CIA and the NSA and other parts of the government that have investigated it. Most people fall into one of two camps. It's just a hoax. People get sick, they start thinking they're coming down with Havana syndrome. Other people believe it's a result of either some kind of directed energy weapon, which is like, imagine aiming a bunch of microwaves at the building and then getting people sick who are inside there, or perhaps something that's been injected in people or put in the water. But the number of government people who've complained about coming down with these symptoms, and these symptoms are like, your skin feels like it's on fire, you have terrible headaches, you know, you suddenly lose all your energy and you become totally lethargic, can't sleep, you know, can't eat. These symptoms are very real to these people. And there's the number of people who have come down with it, I think it's in the thousands at this point, but it's only in these certain places. So, you know, you put together a guy who wants to get the Americans out of Guantanamo Bay. You put together the possibility that Havana syndrome is real. And, you know, you come up with someone putting together a nefarious plot. That's hopefully a lot of fun for us to unravel.
It is a lot of fun. So you don't shy away from, you know, starting out with the bang. And so in the opening chapter, I can't spoil the book for you by talking about the opening chapter. There is a confrontation and a kind of cruel death that happens. Do you feel like, you know, killing people has to be a part of the tapestry of the book, or do you try to avoid it?
I literally thought you were just going to say, do you feel like killing people is bad? And I was going to say, yes, yes, I do.
No, it's not an ethical question. But, this was a craft question.
It's a trick question, people. I didn't know it was going to be this kind of an interview. No, you know, you have to raise the stakes somehow. And, you know, a lot of us grew up on books and movies and TV shows where, to some extent, all of that stuff is kind of fake. I mean, everybody loves the A-Team, right? We've all seen the A-Team. We love Mr. T. We love, you know, George Peppard, the A-Team. They're great. I think in about 85 episodes of that show, they fired approximately 11,000 rounds of ammunition, and nobody ever got shot. You can't have that if you want people to take it seriously. You know, there's high stakes. You try to create characters that people will connect with, and then you try to put them in danger and or put them in a situation where, yeah, some of them might not make it, but hopefully what happens to them is realistic and legitimate to the story. So yeah.
I thought it was a good opening scene. I wasn't being critical. I was just trying to think back. You guys know Clive's work better than I do. Are there a lot of people who die sort of face to face as opposed to maybe they all went down with the ship or something? What's your feeling?
10 years ago.
How about you? Okay. I mean, I don't remember reading them that, you know, there was a high body. It's not like Jack Reacher, you know. I mean, not a really high body count. Patrick, are you back there? Come out. And because Patrick and I did an interesting event today with John Sanford interviewing Mick Herron, who writes the Slow Horses and all. And both Patrick and I agree that the opening scene of the book starts with a badger. So Patrick actually read the paragraph. It was an amazing scene, wasn't it? So this poor guy, I mean, can you remember it enough to?
You probably need a microphone. Sorry.
Recite it for us. It's not that really that great. Well, it is. But it's something like, there's nothing like the smell of dead badger or something like that. And that's how he opens the book. And you know that he comes across this dead badger, and he gets back. You know it's going to appear later in the scene, and it's this beautifully choreographed opening scene about this guy who was a former spy, and he'd lived in this small village in Devon, right? Devon? Yeah. And something causes him to suddenly, you know, go on the run, and he goes through the village. Anyway, great scene.
He hears somebody breaking into his house, I think.
That's
it was.
Right. That's
and
right.
So he has to flee. And as Patrick says, you know, it's going to circle back to the badger. But my point was that it's a scene that really grabs you. But in this case, it's not a dead person. It's a dead badger that, you know, so there's a dead something.
See, he was zigging when everybody else zagged. He's really learned the right lessons.
You know, I think that very often thrillers do need to start with a high action opening scene, you know, where something dramatic occurs, and often people are in jeopardy.
Yeah, I think obviously that's what we try to do. You want to grab the reader right off the bat. But I'm okay with stories that start slower. We don't tend to do that. We tend to jump right into the action. But you really, if you strip away the action, what you should find in that first chapter is a mystery, right? The first thing you need is something that people go, okay, what's happening here? I know something's happening here, but I'm not 100% sure what it is, and now I want to read the rest of the book to find out.
Right. Well, the question in the scene that we were talking about is, who's breaking in? This guy's been retired for 20 years, so who's breaking into his... The badger's dead, but the guy goes on the run. And the question, of course, is, you know, why? What's
right.
his history in the whole
What thing? Happened? How did this happen, exactly?
Right. So you're right. So this one, we can at least talk about it. Two guys are in a car.
Yeah, so... You know, a lot of times you see the hero or a hero in the opening scene, but we wanted to open this book on the guy who ultimately becomes one of the main villains. And, you know, he's in Cuba. They're driving an old car through, you know, some of the small towns of Cuba, going to where this secret project is being run. And the whole idea is the Cuban government has decided to shut it down. And the villain, our guy Colon, he decides he's not going to have that. He's not going to have this project shut down. In fact, he has bigger plans for it. So the guy who you think is his sidekick and his boss and his, you know, overseer, he ends up meeting a sudden and untimely death. But, you know, hopefully that sets the tone. You thought these guys were on the same side, but they're not. And you should be able to, you know, what we're hoping to reveal is here is a villain who's actually, he's not exactly what you think he is. He's more for himself than he is for any country. So
then we have a scene where a lot of people are in jeopardy out in the water, which is sort of a crucial part of a Numa book. But, you know, is it, do you like revisiting the basic Numa characters in every book, and do you try to change them at all? Kurt Austin, Jove, Savalov, whatever, you know, how do you sort of keep them the same but make them different?
Yeah, that's the hardest, that, you know, of all the things, that's, you want to change them, but you don't want to change them too much.
Right.
You know, we all have great characters that we love, whether they're in books or in TV shows or movies. And if we suddenly open the book or turn on the next episode or see the sequel to the movie and our characters aren't who we remember them to be or who we want them to be, we're going to be disappointed and we're going to get, you know, loud noises in the ceiling.
Right. I know. We're definitely going to have to get it fixed.
But at the same time, if they're exactly the same, they can become stagnant. So it's, you know, it's subtle changes. I think it's subtle changes, yeah.
Right. So you didn't actually create NUMA, the National Underwater and Marine Agency, but these kinds of books work well if there is a sort of, if not off the, well, not a formal government kind of agency that, you know, has funding and direction and a staff and all those good things. NUMA's a wonderful creation.
Yeah, so the amazing thing is that Clive went and created his real NUMA after he started writing about it in the books, which always cracks me up, because the NUMA in the books has like an almost unlimited budget, especially in the older ones. Sometimes, you know, there'd be something and it'd be like, this cost $360 million, but Sandecker took care of it out of the slush fund. And like, that's a pretty good slush fund. But hey, everybody wants to work for a company like that, right? Or an agency that has unlimited budget. But then Clive would tell me about some adventure they were going on and the little tiny boat they were renting, and they had like a little NUMA sign that they taped to the side. It's like, not quite as much budget for the real NUMA as there was for the NUMA in the books. But yeah, I mean, it's... You know, that's another one of the things, you go back and forth between, you want the characters to have to survive on their wits, or do you want them to have, you know, the full support of the government and the agencies and all the things that help. And you just try to do what's, you know, it's organic one way or another. It usually makes the most sense.
Right. So the Oregon Files is a completely different chain of command and
Mike
all
Madden,
that other
yeah.
stuff. Right. I really loved the last book that Boyd and Clyde did, the last two books that they did together, where, you know, the suggestion was, let's sink the Oregon. It's getting old, whatever it is. But then the other side of the coin was, you have to build a new one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember Boyd Morrison and I are good friends, and we were friends before we started working with Clive. And it was one of the great adventures or times in all of our lives to like be able to get together with Clive and the three of us, or, you know, even with additional people, and just kind of talk story and stuff like that. And Boyd and I talked a lot about stories, and I remember him telling me when they were going to sink the Oregon, and it's, my recollection is a little vague, but he's like, I'm gonna sink the Oregon, and he's like, but Clive's forcing me to A, commit to another book where we resurrect the new Oregon. And he said he wanted to make one change, and I may have the story wrong, but he wanted to make sure that this was the one and only time the Oregon, which is a secret ship that always flies under like Liberian flags and whatever, when they were going down in battle, they raised the American flag, and that was like the last, you know, the only time they'd ever raised the American flag. It's just a really cool scene.
That is right. I thought that was, what do you think, you could do anything that dramatic in the NUMA universe?
You know, we don't have anything. See, the Oregon is kind of like the Starship Enterprise, right?
Know.
So
right,
you
exactly.
have this thing that is, it's like another character.
Yeah.
We don't really have that in Numa. Maybe we should, we got money. We should probably build one. We should probably build something of our own that becomes an iconic machine. But, you know, our guys are usually relying on their own wits more than the technology.
Well, all right. So how are the Numa guys moving around? What is their hardware?
Well, I mean, it just depends on where they are. So a lot of this book, they are on a Numa ship. Numa has its own fleet of ships, and they're like exploration ships. They're not warships or anything like that. But then as this story goes on, they realize that they're going to kind of have to do whatever they're going to do and do it undercover to some extent.
Okay.
So at one point, they're in the Bahamas, and they meet an old friend of Kurt's, and next thing you know, they're on a sailboat out in the middle of nowhere, and that's kind of their mode of transportation for this book. Until at some point, I assure you, they will get upon the airships, and then all kinds of chaos will ensue.
Right. So when you finish one, because it takes a long time to get a book into production, so it's been at least a year, I imagine, since you turned this one in. You want to give us a little preview of the next, or would you rather not talk about a work in progress?
Yeah, I will say there is another one in progress, but I'm going to leave it at that because the last thing you want to do is put an idea out there and then suddenly someone else not even steals it, but you put these things out into the universe and suddenly, I mean, I may have told this story before too, but before I got my first book published, I had written my first book and I decided I wanted to just try to do a different book and send that out and let the first book kind of just be my practice book. I started working on this story and I was into about 100 pages and it was a great spy story with a unique twist. Until I went into a bookstore and picked up a book that had the exact same twist and the exact same story connected to it. And I'm just like, well, there's 6 months down the drain. But so it's like you kind of want to keep these things under your hat, I think, until you're ready to publish them.
But the critical question was you are actually writing another book.
Yep, there's another one underway. And somehow, as usual, we're always coming up against a deadline.
No.
Yes, there's always a deadline somewhere. I don't know how this. You know, I was told when I got into this that it would be like the life of leisure. You'd write for a little bit, and then you'd like tour Europe, and you'd sit around in bars in Key West and just drink margaritas and tequila, and maybe go fishing, and then at some point maybe you'd get back into writing. And I feel like I've worked like 364 days a year. It seems like so. That part hasn't happened yet, but we'll see. Maybe.
One of the reasons that I really love reading these books is that you get to learn so much. And I'm assuming that, you know, your research is reasonably reliable, which, you know, we have to hope it is. I think it's, you know, most of us are not leading lives of extraordinary adventure, right? So we get a chance to go and do adventurous things with new technology, new equipment, you know, see guys getting themselves out of hopeless situations, the whole bit. So it's a vicarious kind of a life.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all live a weird combination of high stress lives, but actually low amount of being able to get out and actually do the things that stress is meant to make you run faster, jump higher, fight more fiercely. I mean, it's a natural thing. We live under stress in our offices and in our cars and you don't have that. We don't have that outlet for the most part here in the 21st century. But books like this, I think not only do they let you escape into another world, which is always what I've tried to do, it's supposed to be another world. You're supposed to be able to get into it and be fully immersed into it. And for that hour or two a day that you're reading it, you're not in that world of commutes and traffic and the boss want to know where the files are and why the work isn't done and, you know, and the bills coming in and whatever else is going on. You're actually in this different world where you're having an adventure. And I think, just like I said, it's personally, you're kind of living vicariously through it, but you're also getting to escape the regular world for a little while. And I think that helps you deal with the regular world better when you come back.
Oh, I do too. I love going to all these exciting places, many of which I've been to, but not Cuba so far. So we'll see. So questions. Any of you have questions that you would like to ask? Come on.
So the question is, how do we do our research? And the second part of the question is, do we get to travel to places like Cuba and stuff like that? And the answer is yes, except we never really get to because we're so busy that we never get there. In a perfect world, go to Cuba, spend a few months in Cuba, go down in the Caribbean, you know, scuba dive and do all this stuff and go fly on airships. But in reality, you're usually learning what you can, talking to people, you know, reading, you don't get to do as much of the fun part that as I would like to. You know, I would like to get it written into the next contract that I get to go to all the good places first, but it's not really probably going to happen.
You're relatively new dad, so you have an additional drag on this whole idea of going places, but eventually, you know.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's funny because you're as busy as you could possibly be, it seems like, all the time. Like, people keep asking me what I read and how much I read, and I was just like, I don't read that much anymore because I don't have the time. Maybe when I'm retired, I can read all these books in here. How much do you get to read?
Don't ask. I have to say that the two puppies that we acquired a couple of years ago have certainly cut into my reading time. Their puppies are almost as much work as babies. It's amazing how much work they are. Right, Patrick? You have dogs. I know. I mean, they all came home from the groomer today, all three of them. They were so proud showing off and, you know, smelling so good and all the rest of it. And so you have to take time out to, you know, praise them and cuddle them and the whole bit. And there goes like three chapters. Boom.
You know, that's absolutely true. In fact, as soon as you stop paying attention to them, then that's when they're going to come up and just, you know, I just have dogs and cats. And as soon as I stop paying attention to dogs and try to do something, you know, they're into something and knocking something over. And as soon as I stop paying attention to cats, they jump up on the desk and start chewing on the papers that I'm trying to read. So they know when you're not paying attention, and they'll figure out a way to get you to do it.
Very true. Anybody else have a question they'd like to ask? Come on, guys. You're supposed to be. All right. No, it's okay. You go, and then he'll go.
We'll get everybody. You know, I mean, I don't know that it requires that. I mean, you have to know to some extent some things. I wasn't in the Navy or anything like that, but you know, I've been out on boats plenty of times, and I've done some diving and stuff like that. But I'm by no means a Dirk Pitt or Kurt Austin or Jacques Cousteau or any of those guys. But you got to know a little bit. But even then, you still get things wrong all the time. You know, Clive would correct me on certain things. And then, you know, sometimes if we miss it, somebody who's like an expert commercial diver will be like, well, on page 253, you had the guy doing this, and he couldn't do this because he did this earlier. So it's and I was like, you're right. Oh, yeah, forget it. Yeah, absolutely. But that's okay. They're reading the books.
If you make up some stuff, then nobody can actually call you on it. Technology or whatever it is, if it's all. I mean, I don't know how many people really know that much about airships at the moment, so it gives you some freedom.
Yeah, and the more, that's true. The more fictional stuff you put in there that has absolutely nothing to do with reality, there's no, you know, I'm waiting for the day someone calls me and says, like, or sends me an email and, like, you know, the ray gun that you used on page 539, they don't work that way. And it's like, that's when I'm going to have to like change email addresses or something like that.
There's actually been quite a lot of research done about the Havana syndrome. And so far it's all said that it isn't real, but it's hard to imagine this many people in this many places that are not contiguous or even associated could have the same kind of symptoms if there wasn't something weird going on. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because it's definitely one of those things where there's a split one part of the government came out with a big report saying it's just mass hysteria. And then another government agency said they absolutely believe something's going on here and it has to do with our foreign adversaries. So we'll find out at some point, you know.
We will. Yes, sir. You had a question over there. Are you writing anything of your own? When would you have time?
Yes, that therein lies the problem. You know, I always am. You're always, as an author, you're always thinking or you're conjuring some idea that some of them make sense and some of them don't. But you start to follow a line of thought and it starts to coalesce into a story in your mind. And then you kind of think, "Ooh, I want to work on that." And a lot of the times, my energy is focused on the Pneumophiles books. So it's pretty easy to be like, ooh, this would be a great idea for the next Pneumophiles, or this would be a great idea, or maybe this would be a good idea for somebody else. But, you know, a lot of times some of these ideas are like, this has nothing to do with the Pneumophiles or even an action adventure story or even, you know, something that would fit into that genre. And then they go kind of just go on a list of like things I may get to someday. But right now, not working on anything except Pneumophiles.
Right. But I did bring up the point that that was what he was writing before he began to write with Clive. And so that's your kind of natural inclination.
Well, and at times during working on the Pneumophiles and working on my own books, I've branched out to do some other stuff. I wrote a couple of vampire books with an author by the name of Spencer Andrews, who basically we self-published them, and a lot of people liked them. And there's a third book that's supposed to have been gotten finished about 5 years ago that has never been finished. And I know there's people out there that are going, where's that third book? Because in the back of the second book, it said, coming next spring. And that was about 5 years. So I apologize. Mate, one of these days, guys, one of these days. And then a science fiction story we did about colonizing Mars called The Gods of War, which that was kind of a standalone, but it left room for a sequel that I'd like to get to at some point. But there is only so much time, and you can only do what you can do.
Anyone else? No? Yes.
So has this become your full-time profession?
Yes, absolutely. I'm very fortunate. Not every author gets to do that, you know. And I'll do that as long as I can, and I'll be happy to go work at Lowe's after that, and not have anybody, you know, and not have any deadlines or anything, any high pressure scenarios. Just I'll work and I'll write. I mean, I'll read. Finally, I'll get to read.
So you have big shoes to fill with Clive. Fallen very well in line with his characters that he, you know, and stuff like that. Is there anybody looking over your shoulder saying, you know, that didn't really fall, you know, that's, or are you giving carte blanche and saying, this is how I'm going to run it? And with
no, I mean, you know, I work with Dirk Kussler now. He took over for his dad, and you know, we have a really good working relationship. He has a lot of his dad's gifts and intuition. And when we are bantering back and forth, you know, about story and plot lines and stuff, it's very similar. It's different because Clive was older and he was the original and more accomplished. And you know, Dirk and I are kind of similar of age. So it's more like brothers than like a father figure or an Obi-Wan Kenobi. Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, there's also an editor, you know. I mean, there's a series editor at Putnam, the publisher too. So no author just gets to completely fly free. It doesn't work out that way.
It hasn't worked out that way yet, but one of these days I'm just gonna write my own thing and just send it in, not listen to anybody, and then they'll fire me, and then I'll have time to read.
Actually, within the framework, you have a lot of freedom.
Yeah, I feel like
it's not like a straitjacket or anything.
No,
you know?
Not at all.
They're not formulaic. I mean, you do have touchstones that you have to meet, but aside from all that, you know, you're pretty much free to do whatever you want with the story.
I would say 90%, 95% of the stories if they just gave me like complete freedom and I said, this is the idea I want to do, and they said, go ahead and do it, that's how we'd have the same story. The only difference is it would probably be longer because I get more long-winded and then I have to edit everything down. But other than that, it's usually, yeah, I mean, I think the stories would come out the same because there's definitely enough freedom that basically I end up writing what I believe works best for the Numa stories. And only at certain times do we, you know, make major changes or even anything you could call major change.
I mean, Clive conceived the universe, but universes change, you know, with time. They're dynamic. And, you know, you have a few characters and a few, you know, Numa itself, the whole bit. But, you know, it's all fairly flexible inside that framework.
Yeah, well, and some characters, you know, characters come and go. I'm curious if this guy's watching. We were signing books earlier, and some people ask for, most people just want a signature. Some want signature and date. Other people want some kind of inscription. And there was one gentleman whose his request was, you know, it was his name said, you know, can you just make this out to Duke? And then, you know, sign it. And I'm like, I wonder if he knows that there was a character named Duke in like three or four books ago. I can't even remember which book it was in. I'm going to have to find out. But it would have been great if I could remember which book it was in. I'll be like, I'll send him this book. And he'll think he's the character in the book. So, yeah. But characters come and go. But the main characters, you know, I think it was Tom Clancy who said a new Clive Cussler book is like a visit from an old friend. And that's what you're looking for. You want the characters to be the people just like you want your best friends to be the people you need them to be. That's what you're expecting when you get the book. So
very true. Anybody else?
Any chance you might do a crossover between the different Clive Cussler's series and bring them together?
You know, it was talked about once or twice. It's so much more complicated than you would think it is, especially if it goes along for multiple books, because, well, how do you end one book without it's not like the movies where you can end it and it's not really a finale. The people will feel cheated. So it's really hard to do. That said, Boyd Morrison and I did a scene. There's a Numa Files book and a Oregon Files book where the characters happen to be in the same place at the same time. And you see the scene from two different points of views, and takes place on the island of Malta. I think it was, I can't remember any of the names of the books. I think it was Secret of the Pharaohs, and I can't remember what the Oregon Files book was. But this was one chapter, and it legitimately took Boyd and I 4 or 5 weeks of going back and forth just to make sure the details were the same. And every time we thought we had it, I'm like, well, why are they over here? He's like, oh, well, they had to go over there because of that. Okay, I'll change that. And then he's like, why are your guys doing this? I'm like, well, they had to find a way to sneak into the warehouse. He's like, okay, I'll change that. And I'm like, why are your guys wearing tuxedos? He's like, because they just came from a party. I'm like, what party? He's like, there's a party in the museum. I'm like, all right, I got to change that. You know, and it was just the amount of times we thought we had it done and we had to go back again. I've never worked so hard. I literally a month and a half on one chapter. So I don't think there's going to be a full book that's a crossover.
Well, maybe the question was, would you pull a character from Numa from the Oregon Files and have him in a Numa? But I'm not sure that you can really do that.
They cross over a little bit from time to time. They're mentioned. You know, we've mentioned Oregon Files in our books and Juan Cabrillo in our books. And Juan Cabrillo came into existence in a Dirk Pitt book and then branched. So there are times that a character does like a cameo, but it's really hard to do a full crossover.
Got it. Right. Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening. Thank you, virtual audience. We're glad you joined us. Graham has signed loads of books. Actually, most of them are already sold, but we do have a few left. And if you'd like to get your books signed, those of you who are here, we'd love to have you. So thank you, Graham. Let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you, guys.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.